I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The Moroccan sociologist Fatima Mernissi is in a bookstore. She's looking at a painting of a plump, sprawling, nude woman. She's been inspecting numerous Western reproductions of this legendary Arabic storyteller by the name of Scheherazade. Now, Scheherazade, you may recall, is the woman from Arabian Nights, who told scintillating stories night after night to a particularly vengeful sultan, saving herself and hundreds of other women from certain death. So Fatima looks at this picture of Scheherazade, the large, naked woman, and she furrows her brow.
Scheherazade must be thin.
Of course she should be thin. She's up all night, stressed out, spinning tales under threat of death, sacrificing herself and her intellect and her wit. This is all clear to Fatima, but as she looks at the painting, she knows she's seeing across a vast cultural divide between the Muslim world and the West, and between men and women. Fatima Mernissi has found that when the story of Scheherazade or other kept women of the harem is translated by Western men, it turns into a brainless image of erotic, exotic desire. Listen to this music. Now, what Fatima Mernissi sees in the translation are answers to a great mystery of misunderstanding between the Muslim world and the West. Connection listeners, what did happen to Scheherazade in her trip from East to West? What is being or has been lost in the translation? And what do these images of the harem tell us about how men understand women and vice versa, from Baghdad to Casablanca to Paris and to Hollywood? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Our number is 1-800-423-TALK. You can, of course, join us online at theconnection.org. My guest is Fatima Mernissi. Her new book is called Scheherazade Goes West, and she's with me in the studio. Welcome to the program.
Merci.
This all started because you were curious about the way that Western men heard the word harem.
Yes. When My book, Dreams of Trespass, appeared and was translated in 28 languages. I went to do the tour, the book tour, and I met something like 100 journalists. Most of them were men. And every time my book starts, I was born in a harem, and they'll smile when they pronounce the word harem. And I was shocked because for me, harem is not funny, or it's a family, just synonym of family. I was saying, why are they smiling? It became evident that for me, they were seeing their own harem fantasy, and their harem was funny. So I started inquiring, what's the Western harem, what's funny about this Western harem? Why the men are smiling when they say it?
Now, one of your journeys in the book, as you're trying to figure this out, takes you to the Louvre Museum in Paris. You go there with your friend Jacques, and he wants to show you a painting.
Yes, and the painting was La Grande Odalisque by Ingres. And he was very,
taken with it.
Emotional. Yeah. And he didn't want me to talk when he was looking at his odalisque. And I was surprised that she was nude and vulnerable. And that attracted him because in the harem, in, let's say, the fantasy of the harem in the Muslim world, in paintings or in literature like Scheherazade, the attractive woman is clever. She has a brain, and therefore there is conflict. You cannot be relaxed like Jacques was in front of his odalisque.
I should tell our listeners that if they want to take a look at the Ingres painting, it is on the homepage of our website at theconnection.org, and it's very much as you describe it. You chose Scheherazade as the character who would help us understand this difference between the way that Western men view Eastern women. Now, why did you choose Scheherazade? Why is she a good character for this?
Yes, I really think that the big divide about beauty between East and West is that for, I cannot say Muslim, but let's say for Arabs, because I don't speak Iranian and Turkish and I cannot speak for Muslims, unlike the Western media, which are always talking about Muslims as if there is such a thing as a Muslim. But the beauty is intelligence. You know, that's it. Sex is this intelligence, this sexy woman is this intelligent Shahrazad who has this brain, which is dazzling. And that's why the man has to be on his guard all the time, because you don't relax in sex or in sexual relation. It's conflict because the woman is clever.
And you say that in the world of Scheherazade, without this cerebral conflict or confrontation, there can be no genuine sex, no orgasm. It just doesn't happen.
Absolument. And this is why pornography, we don't understand it. We don't understand pornography. It's really a Western thing. I mean, this sex without a brain, that's what I will call pornography. It's only bodies moving. There is no story, no nothing.
Now, you have to give us the view from the other side as well, because certainly in the last few months, as there has been so much conflict and attempt to try and understand what's happening in different parts of the world, there's been a lot written, many photographs in the United States of Arab women who are veiled, Arab women who live behind closed doors. And if this sort of intellectual equality that you're talking about is a part of, and well, I'll use your term, the Arab world, how do you explain those elements of the society?
Yes. You see, I'll tell you, the Westerners are focused on veiled women. In my university, in Morocco, the veil is not imposed by the state, because this is the big divide, the big thing the Westerners have to understand. Only despotic states impose the veil. But in Morocco, the veil is not imposed like in the majority. So you can choose, and it's like choosing to have a hat or on your head or to have your hair uncovered. But I see when a journalist comes, a Western journalist, to the university, he goes to my colleague who has the veil on. It's because he is attracted to the veil. And the Westerners, the media mostly, they are not interested in women who are unveiled in the Muslim world. And that's the majority. You know, there is a huge invasion of scientific field by women, for example.
But I know in my own experience traveling and working in the Arab world that often for a male journalist, a veiled woman is very unapproachable. That I make the assumption when I see the veil that this woman has chosen not to make herself available for an interview, for a conversation. But if I see you on the street with your head uncovered, I'll say, excuse me, ma'am, do you have a moment to talk to me?
Yes.
So it does work both ways.
Yes. Bien sûr. And it is true that if you put the veil on, it means that you want to keep you are putting a barrier.
Privacy.
You see, in Morocco, there is on the beach, one of my next books is 1 million Muslim at the beach. Because in the summer, all Moroccans flock into the beach, on the Atlantic beach where I am. And I have, but comes in the beach, men and women who are also veiled women are on the beach. And it is true, I have noticed that if you see a veiled woman, there is a little space around her, which is an incredible advantage, because the beach is so crowded. So what you said is right. But I'm talking about another phenomena, is that the Westerners, they like Muslims to be archaic. And only veiled women are attractive to them.
Because they fit in this sort of storybook notion that we have from old films or old books. Is that Is that perhaps why you think Western men prefer those images?
I'm talking about both Western and Eastern men. I think it's because they think modernity is only Western. It's their privilege.
Right.
We have no right to modernity. And therefore, when they see me with my hair cut and my leather skirt, actually it's tradition, but I am making it into modern, they see me as just a banal image of Western woman. The one who is more traditional is the veiled one, and she is more Arab in a way to them. Say, this is what I'm talking about.
Connection listeners, my guest is Fatima Mernissi. Her latest book, Scheherazade Goes West, is the basis of our conversation today. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. And I'm going to ask you, Fatima, if you can just read for us the beginning of the book. Give our listeners a taste of your word on the page. Would you do that for us?
Yes. So the first is the tale of the lady with the feather dress, which is a story from 1001 Nights, that women have wings, they can fly. And I like this idea. If by chance you were to meet me at the Casablanca airport or on a boat sailing from Tangiers, you would think me self-confident, but I am not. Even now, at my age, I am frightened when crossing borders because I am afraid of failing to understand strangers. To travel is the best way to learn and empower yourself, said Yasmina, my grandmother, who was illiterate and lived in a harem, traditional household with locked gates that women were not supposed to open. You must focus on the strangers you meet and try to understand them. The more you understand a stranger, and the greater is your knowledge of yourself, the more power you will have. For Yasmina, the harem was a prison, a place women were forbidden to live. So she glorified travel and regarded the opportunity to cross boundaries as a sacred privilege, the best way to shed powerlessness. And indeed, rumors ran wild in Fez, the medieval city of my childhood, about trained Sufi masters who got extraordinary flashes, lawamir, and expanded their knowledge exponentially simply because they were so focused on learning from the foreigners who passed through their lives.
That's the voice of Fatima Mernissi reading from her latest book, Scheherazade Goes West. Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. And what we're talking about this hour is understanding the mistakes and the perceptions that exist in the way that men understand women, in the way that men look at images of women between East and West, and how we seem to, more often than not, just get it wrong. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from National Public Radio. You're listening to The Connection. My name is Dick Gordon, and we are traveling this hour with the Moroccan sociologist Fatima Mernissi into the harems of Morocco and Persia, a place, she says, where women were active and fully aware of the discomforts of their home. And we travel then out the back door onto the Hollywood stage, where you wake up to find five exotic, beautiful, and easy women leaning over you. Imagine you're Elvis.
Hey, you're real. All of you.
And entirely at your service, noble master.
Well, that's very nice, honey, but would you mind telling me where I am?
In the Garden of Paradise, noble master.
Oh, I could have told you that.
Of course, Elvis Presley and Harem in the 1965 film Harem Scarum. And I guess there's a lot to be learned from how American popular culture created its own image of the harems of the Arab world. Connection listeners, as you listen to Fatima Mernissi, what do you see? What informs your vision of the harem and the women in it? And Fatima, you found a lot of men told you that when they imagined a harem, it was something very like that scene from the Elvis Presley movie.
Oh, you see, when she says, "Noble master," an Arab man will be quickly to stand on his feet and say, "Ah, she is trying to play game on me." You see, if a woman plays, she is obedient, the man knows it's a game because she definitely is not obedient. But in the Western harem, that's the man likes that, and I don't know, are you, now I ask you, when a woman tells you, "Monsieur Gordon, my noble master," what do you think? That she is do you like it, or do you say, this is dangerous? What do you think?
Yeah, a little bit of both. I guess it depends on the circumstances. I'm going to have a hard time avoiding this question, but the whole image that we have of the women reclining on the sofas, dressed in their see-through clothing and beckoning with a finger, come into the harem. This is what we are raised in popular culture to understand the harem to be. But it's a very mythical place.
Yes,
not something that we actually imagine exists behind the walls in cities like Rabat or you know what I mean?
Mm. But it is mythical in any culture. You see, the harem is mythical. It's really, I think, a protection device, you know. But the difference, I think, is in the Western, in the Eastern harem, the men know that the women are not obedient and they are not obeying the rule that they shouldn't get out or bring men in. Actually, in 1001 Nights Stories, there is a lot of stories about the Caliph Harun al-Rashid, my beloved Harun al-Rashid, to whom I devote a lot of chapters. He was betrayed by his Jariya, but by his slave girls. But in the Western harem, the man denies the woman, takes away her brain. She is beautiful, therefore she has no brain. This is, I think, is the why he is relaxed in his harem, while the Muslim man is not relaxed in his harem. If he imprison a woman, he knows she is going to fight back. But in the Western harem, the beauty has no intelligence. Am I wrong or right?
I don't know. I'm going to test your theory with our connection listeners. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going first to Karen, calling in from Columbia, South Carolina. Hello, Karen.
Hello, Professor Mernissi. This is such an honor to speak with you. I've read your work in anthropology classes and enjoyed your book on Scheherazade tremendously. It was wonderful. My question is this, and it perhaps jumps a little in both cultures, but in different ways. Men pursue the fantasy of ultimate superiority. In the Western culture, women's brains are eliminated. They don't exist. Women are beautiful. In the Eastern culture, it's a terrible generalization, but you show a good picture that the women are enforced in helplessness, some of them. The picture is of imprisonment through some mechanism, and the harem is the most visible one. But there's a suggestion that women are combative, intelligent, capable, but still the superiority enforced by force is successful. Where does this emerge from in both cultures? You bridge between the two, and I wonder what you think.
You see, I am going to surprise you, but I haven't. This is the question I started with, but I don't have the answer. All what is still there is Why do men and women everywhere have such a hard time enjoying life? My God, why? You know, and I spent 4 years working on this book and I don't know the answer, but I think it's worthwhile. At least East and West have something to work on together. And men and women, you see, in the only thing is in the Arab world, feminism or the conflict between the sexes. Men are feminists in the Arab world. We think that you cannot solve the problem if you don't get men to think about this issue of sex conflict and how we can make it better.
And yet I hear people saying, Taliban, Taliban, these people aren't feminists. You know, this is what...
Yes, people... but they are not. I mean, Taliban is extremism. It's like the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah.
I never confuse Americans with the Ku Klux Klan.
Ku Klux Klan. I can't say it either.
Ku Klux Klan. We'll know what
you're talking
about. Yeah, KKK.
There we go. Thanks, Karen. All right, but and that's a parallel that we should understand. Karen?
Yes.
Well, I'm glad to know that you think the question is worthwhile. Perhaps.
Are you disappointed that there's not an answer, Karen?
No, no. I mean, but it's a scary thought. Perhaps Western feminists have something to contribute, which is that men are frightened of the question. Eliciting their assistance and support is wonderful, and when it's possible, it's terrific and much needed. But perhaps we have discovered something, which is that men are not interested, perhaps, as much as we would like to believe, in enjoying life, if it means giving up what they perceive as a lonely and debilitating superiority. I mean, men in the West die so much earlier than women, live so much more constricted emotional lives. Their physical health is so bad.
I'm getting really depressed listening to you. You know that, Karen.
Well, but Dr. Munisi pursues difficult questions with fearlessness. So I'll hang up and enjoy her conversation. But once again, much thanks to you for contributing.
But you know what? I will tell you what you are saying about men is the same about men in the Arab world. I have discovered one thing, which is that in East or West, men are not allowed to talk about fear. You see, as a woman, I don't have many privileges. But I have one privilege, which is I can scream that I am afraid. But an Arab man is not allowed, and neither is a Western man. And what I am saying is maybe our job is to make it possible for men to talk about fear. And I am convinced that if we can change the rule which censors men from talking about their fear, they will use less arms. I don't know. Maybe I am wrong.
Well, maybe you're right. Karen, thank you for your call. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We go to Acton, Massachusetts now, and Andrew is joining us. Hello, Andrew.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I would just like to say that on behalf of many American men, we do not share the same harem fantasy that seems to be projected here. We are not all the same. Some of us do crave intelligent, challenging, perhaps even conflicted women, and we're drawn to them. We engage them. Not all of us are looking to be fed grapes by 5 or 10 women at a time or anything like that. It's a nice fantasy, but most of us embrace the reality of strong, vibrant, challenging women.
But you're tripping on your own words. You're talking about the fantasy of the grape peelers versus the reality of the strong women. I mean, if you reverse the two, Andrew.
Well, what I'm saying is that we do seek these women out, you know, the intelligent ones, you know, that everyone, you know, there's the fantasy and then there's the reality that we engage, but not many of us engage in the harem fantasy at all, I think. I think that's a gross misconception. I think we have evolved a lot since the 40s and 50s, and we are looking for intellectual partners, intellectual challenges in our women.
Andrew, how old are you?
38.
Ah, oui. Listen, just before coming here, I was in Germany presenting the book. And I was confronted by young German men telling me that I was totally wrong, that they don't want the model the who are on the fashion, which is stupid girl playing stupid, that they liked intelligent partners. So I am not surprised, and I am not hanging to my fantasies. I am ready to change, and I am happy to hear. And I'm not surprised at all, because I imagine that all the changes which happened since the 70s, when I was here as a student, about feminism and women's beauty and all that, I am not surprised to see that there is people like you, that this young generation are at ease with intelligence partners.
Is it your belief, though, that you can make a distinction based on generations, that the...
I am not surprised, because I see changes in the Arab world. And Andrew's age, Arab men, they like partners, and they are into partnership. I want, therefore, to ask Andrew one question. You see, in the next book, I am studying civil society. I don't work on women anymore, but civil society, because I have noticed that in the civic space, these NGOs and associations booming in Morocco, in the field of the men and women are into partnership, into collaboration. But then I noticed something. In these couples, the sex roles are not figé, they are not fixed. Like the man would be one moment taking care of the kid or cooking, and the next time, you know, there is no fixed sex roles. The man could be doing a woman's chore, and then next time he would be playing football. Is it the same thing for your generation?
Hang on just half a second, Andrew, while I tell our listeners. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Andrew.
It's quickly becoming that way. I mean, I've always felt the need to share roles, to share labors of the house with a woman I was currently with. I'm currently unattached at the moment, just recently broken up. But the sharing, the division of labor, I think, is something that most younger American men accept as a given, you know. And, you know, if a man has a talent for cooking, he'll do the cooking. If he has a talent for breadwinning, he'll be the breadwinner. I think that one thing that we have to get away from is pigeonholing men, pigeonholing women, to say that, you know, there are men out there who do embrace the harem fantasy, who actually perhaps even go to the point of seeking it out. But there are men actually who are, as I say, engaging women and looking for constructive partners to assist them. I mean, right now, I would like nothing better than a woman who I could bring up my business problems with in my life. And, you know, I have many of those, given the state of the economy these days. But I'm also finding that those are few and far between. I'm finding the men are few and far between who are capable of, understanding things that I'm attempting. The lack of intelligence in the world in general depresses me.
But it's nice to know that you're with an intelligent program like ours, Andrew. So thanks for calling us. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And we're going to Cambridge, Massachusetts. Marla is joining us. Hello, Marla.
Hi. Professor Mernissi, I caught some of your talk at MIT, although quite a group was out in the hall. And you did comment for a moment on the post-September 11th experience in the Arab world, and in particular in relation to what you're talking about today. I was wondering, one of the things our government is saying is that we are liberating women in the world where terrorism exists, quote unquote. And as the war expands in Afghanistan and as Iraq is on their plate, I was wondering if since you're an interesting commentator on how the West perceives the East, how you experienced how the U.S. government is laying out what's at stake as we move into areas where they claim terrorism is on the agenda.
Well, about this liberating women, first of all, I wrote a piece on post-Gulf War. It's called The Emperor's New Clothes, New Frontier. Only if civility has no borders will terrorism vanish. And my idea there is Taliban. In 1996, Taliban were financed and supported by UNOCOL, the oil company, the American oil company. And I have written extensively on the fact that the oil companies played and financed terrorism, including the Taliban, because they thought that it was going to
provide terrorism. Some stability, at least.
Well, it reduces, you know, the extremism. Let's call it extremism, just to make extremism in the Middle East, supporting extremism in the Middle East and despots will reduce the number of players on the political podium, so that you have only to deal with the king or the head of the Taliban and all that, but not democracy was perceived as against the interests of the American people. I think that's what changed after the September 11th. So that...
I'm going to get you to finish that thought when we come back. We have to take a short break.
Okay.
Marla, stay with us. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest is Fatima Mernissi. Her latest book is Scheherazade Goes West. And we'd like your thoughts on the perceptions, the realities, the way that men and women see each other within countries and across borders. 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. My name is Dick Gordon. My guest is Fatima Mernissi. Her latest book is Scheherazade Goes West. Fatima, you were just going to finish up a point on Marla's question.
Yes, Marla's question is very simple. The America is perceived by both men and women as having been supporting oppressive despots and extremists which were against women. So I don't understand how ever in anyone's mind we will that America would be liberating women. We just think it's Mr. Rumsfeld military propaganda, which is very grossière to us.
All right, Marla, thank you very much for your call. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. But what I'd like you to do next, if I could, is jump to the very end of the book, because through Scheherazade Goes West, you're talking about the Western inability to come to terms, to understand what it is to have women in a harem. And there is an epiphany, there is a moment at the end, which takes you into a department store, I believe, in New York City. Is that right?
Yes, it is. And I just wanted to buy a skirt because I usually travel with this leather skirt, but it was too hot and I needed another one. And then the elegant sales lady in the American store looked at me without moving from her desk and said that she had no skirt my size. In this whole big store, there is no skirt for me, I said. You are joking. I felt very suspicious and thought that she just might be too tired to help me. I could understand that. But then the saleswoman added a condescending judgment, which sounded to me like an imam's fatwa. It left no room for discussion. You are too big, she said. I am too big compared to what, I asked, looking at her intently because I realized that I was facing a critical cultural gap here. Compared to size 6, came the sales lady's reply. Her voice had a clear-cut edge to it that is typical of those who enforce religious laws. Size 4 and 6 are the norm, she went on, encouraged by my bewildered look. Deviant sizes such as the one you need can be bought in special stores.
This actually happened. This was an
yes,
experience
of
that
course.
You had.
Yeah. Yes, yes, yes. I was teaching in 99, I taught at the university, and I discovered that all the teachers, women teachers, they were jogging early in the morning or late at night. They had no time to look at the sunset. And it's very internalized that you have to be skinny. But for me, it's only when I am too bloated that I realize that something is going wrong. But otherwise, I am okay, you know?
Is it the conclusion for you then that whether it's the veil or the closed door or the only you can fit into a size 6 skirt, I mean, that it's oppression no matter how you look at it?
Oh, it's absolutely like the veil in the most a conservative of like Iran or Saudi Arabia, or the police tell you have to wear the veil. Size 6 is terrible and worse because it is physical. I mean, you have to, it's like if they tell me put a veil size 4. Oh, la la, that's really going to be terrible.
Now, one of the things that you say in the book, one of the questions that you ask in the book is whether or not it is just the men in the West who determine what a harem is, what it should look like. And so I have to ask you, in the case of this example, is it just the men who force the women into a size 6 the same way it is just the men who exercise the oppression of the veil? Is there any involvement of the women as well?
The partners in this, definitely yes. I have to say that even me, I dream about the harem. You know when I receive my tax form, I say, my God, if I was in a harem, they never had to pay taxes. You see what I mean? Of course, we are all ambivalent. And in a way, to tell you the truth, what I would like is that we just do what we are doing now, laughing about it all, because to talk while laughing and nothing is sure. We can move. We are nomads. I think that would make it easy for men and women or cultures to understand each other. I am just fed up with imams and fatwas and, all these people who are sure of themselves.
There's an Arabic word, samar.
Ah, oui. That's my favorite word. I would like to engage the world into samar.
Explain it.
Yes, samar is to talk in the night. And usually, night's full moon, 14th of the full moon is the 14th. The moon is full. And it's almost like, you have beautiful moon nights here. And in the night, when you are talking, you don't see clearly the faces of the partner, of the people you are talking. So you could reveal yourself or talk about fear or uncertainties or fragility or ambivalence. You can talk about that in the night. And I love that because when the light comes out, you forget. You are allowed to be
almost a different set of rules.
Absolutely. Yes.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. And we're going to Greensboro, North Carolina. And Buster is joining us. Hi, Buster.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking me. I just wanted to say, I don't think this issue has so much to do with the shortcomings of the Western male, like some people were saying earlier, but more, how these issues are kind of indoctrinated into us from such a young age. I mean, I remember back in elementary school when everybody was running around singing, "There's a place in France where the naked women dance." I just wanted to take you.
I'd forgotten all about that song, Buster.
Well, it's irrelevant in this conversation, you know. So
No, I hear you. I'm saying I hadn't actually thought of it going back that far.
Are you saying that
this begins when we are this
small?
High?
Yes, absolutely. You know what is the big debate now in the Arab world is school books.
Yeah.
This is the big debate. It's about what we are teaching to children, and in a way, I am wondering if in the U.S. there is this debate going on also. I am asking because, of course, you are right.
Buster, what do you think? Do you think that these images that you and I might have been indoctrinated with are not there anymore, or that there is a correctness to school books, school songs?
Well, I don't think there's so much. The school books and school songs that were given by the school, it's just the culture, you know, that is kind of there in childish elementary messing around, you know.
But is it changing?
No, probably not. Probably won't ever.
You know what is my dream? I have a dream, just like
Mr. King.
Monsieur, yes. It's to create a booklet, a children's book for school curricula, which is universal. The Chinese could read it, the Arab could read it, the Japanese and the American child could read that book.
So this is a book without words?
No, it could be. I mean, you can imagine translation, but just to what are the ethical values of understanding each other, of being tolerant of the difference, of learning from the foreigner, which is very strong in Islam, learning from the foreigner, from Sufism. You know, this kind of little book, you could imagine the children around the world will have, where these values of tolerance, of respect of the other, of the difference, and so on, could be shared.
Buster, thanks a lot for your call. I must tell you, Fatima, that I had read your book on the weekend, and we had the scholar Bernard Lewis in, and we were talking about changes in the Arab world, and I made the point to him that in your book, you go through the statistics. How many women are teaching in the science department at the universities in Cairo, and that this is a great force for change. He stopped, he paused, he said, she has it exactly right, that that's in many ways how we're going to see a big change in the East, in the Arab countries,
yes,
that we're not even aware of yet, that this is, it goes back, I suppose, a little bit to your
yes,
civic society.
And by the way, Mr. Lewis, I unlike what's the big debate here against him, I think he is one of the best analysts. I read his first books about the East, and he is incredible. Now, I don't know what's his politics, because I live in Morocco and so on, but I hear there is a big debate about him. But yes, these women are emerging as a force, not only because they have invaded culture, because you see what is forbidden is politics, because men should be controlling politics. But what happened is, with the satellite television, the culture become politics. That they couldn't foresee.
Connection listeners, you're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. We did talk a little while ago about the difference in the way that we understand harem. And one of the things which is different, which I need you to help me with your understanding of, is that in the historical version of the harem, it was a polygamous relationship.
Oh,
there was just one man and many women in the harem.
Mm-hmm.
And that in one sense, that's where perhaps some of the misunderstandings are found, if that's part of a fantasy for men, East or West.
Yes. You see, this is it. Polygamy was never accepted by women in the Muslim world, and never from the beginning. And even in the Quran, it's very difficult to argue that it is sacred. It isn't. In the Quran, it isn't. Because he says, if you cannot be just with the four women, then just refrain and stay with one. And the women never accepted polygamy. And this is the big debate now. In Morocco, there is street marches and stuff.
What are they saying? What's the debate now?
Inequality. It's inequality. There should be one man, one woman, because it's not normal that should be one man.
But there is still
women.
A strong debate saying, no, we should have one man and a number of wives?
Conservative people who have a lot of money to occupy the media or to censor, and censorship is becoming impossible with the satellite TV. This is the news in our part of the world. So this equality, the claim of women claiming equality and changing the private law, you know, about polygamy is very strong. This is the big debate.
You write often in the book about Yasmina. She's your grandmother, is that correct?
She is my grandmother,
She's
yes.
a very wise woman.
Yes.
For someone who lives behind the walls.
You see, this is the false idea about that the walls are real walls. They were never real. This is why I'm saying we go back to the myth. The harem is a myth. It always was a myth because, in fact, barrière for culture, the harem women in the Muslim tradition, like the queens, they always had teachers to teach them. They always loved science because what can you do when you are sitting? You have to learn something.
It's been wonderful having you here to talk Merci. A little bit about your book.
Merci.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
My guest, Fatima Mernissi, her book, Scheherazade Goes West. If you're in the Boston area, Fatima Mernissi will be reading tomorrow night, that's Friday, at Wordsworth Books at Harvard Square at 7 p.m. And throughout the course of our conversation, you've heard us refer to a number of images from the book, images in artwork. You can actually go to our website. We're at theconnection.org and find those images. Look at them yourself. Some of them come from the text. Some of them from the inventiveness and the ingenuity of our web people here at The Connection. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Rousseau, and Doug Sugart. Our noble master is Graham Smith. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
20 women by my side. I'm gonna kiss them all because I've gotta keep them satisfied. Gonna have the best time money can buy. I'm gonna be